Hi, McCartney fans, and welcome to another edition of Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast. We are a Paul McCartney talk show mainly dealing with Paul's solo career, and I'm one of your two co-hosts, Tom Hunyadi. You may know me from my other show, Talk More Talk, where we talk all about the solo Beatles. Joining me today is my co-host, my partner in crime, my buddy, good friend, Andy Nichols. Andy, what's going on, buddy?
Hey, Tom. How you doing? Thanks for having me on again.
Absolutely. No, thanks for being here. I really appreciate, these last couple months with you aboard. It's been great. We're having a good time and, just a lot more fun, in the future.
We're rocking and rolling into 2020.
That's right. I'm kind of excited today. We've got a guest with us, an author who's has a book coming out, I believe, next month, and we'll talk to him more about that in a second here. He is the author of another book called The Beatles Through Headphones, as well as the book we'll be discussing today. It's called the Paul McCartney Catalog, and he's going to get into a little bit more of that today. And his name is Ted Montgomery. Ted, hello. What's going on? Welcome to the show.
Thanks, guys. It's good to meet you finally.
Likewise.
Yes. Glad we were able to finally get connected and get this interview going, and really excited to talk about this new book of yours. But first, let's talk about you for a second, and tell us about yourself and how you became, how you come to be a writer and your fandom for the Beatles and Paul McCartney.
I grew up in suburban Detroit, when my sisters listened to Motown, my three older sisters, and the Monkees. Those were their favorites. I didn't get introduced to the Beatles until they broke up. I first started getting into them. So I never heard a Beatles album new. It had all been out by the time I started listening to it, but I just loved it. And of course, when they broke up and went solo, I stayed loyal to all four of them, two of them more than the other two, but and really, really became a McCartney fan. And over the years, I've seen him 22 times in concert and in many different states and many different band incarnations. And I've also written four books about hockey and spent 10 years or so as a hockey columnist for USA Today.
Oh, wow.
So Wings, Red Wings and Paul McCartney and Wings.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love it. Growing up in Michigan myself, became a pretty big Red Wing fan. Been to many a hockey night in Detroit, and even their minor league team. Was it from Ontario? Mudhens, I think they were.
That was the Detroit Tigers.
No, I'm sorry, not the Mudhens, but what's the team I'm from Ontario for the West?
Spitfires, Windsor?
I think that's it, yeah. Thank you. Been a long time.
Yeah.
Many years and many beers ago.
Right. This is 22 shows, Ted. What was the first tour you saw?
I was 16. This is really going to date me. Uh-huh. And I was the oldest one in my class, so I was the first guy to have a driver's license. Oh. Paul McCartney and Wings were coming to Olympia Stadium in Detroit, long gone Olympia Stadium, where the Wings played for years. And two of my classmates had three tickets but no ride, and they said, "We'll give you the third ticket if you drive." And so that's what I did, May 8th, 1976.
Okay, so you were already as an established Paul fan at this time, at this point, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
And what were your thoughts on his solo output at that point in time?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that, guys, because of course now, so many years later, some of the albums have aged really well, and some of them haven't aged well at all. I always loved Ram. I thought it was really colorful, really Beatle-like, really interesting sounds on that album. And probably my favorite Wings album is Venus and Mars, which was featured heavily on his Wings Over America tour.
Certainly was.
I really love that album a lot.
Yeah. Cool. Very cool. So then, getting into the writing thing, I mean, how did that, how did that fall into your lap?
Did you start as a journalist first and then work your way into writing about McCartney?
No, I've had real jobs all along. I worked for the state senate in Michigan for a while. I worked for Wayne State University in Detroit now. It's always been kind of a sideline. Most people not named Oprah Winfrey or Stephen King don't make money on books, as you guys know.
Right. And,
so it's been a sideline, but it's been a lot of fun, a labor of love. The Beatles book did really well, and I'm announcing here for the first time that it's coming out in a second edition later in 2020 with like 35% new material, which consists mostly of the looks at all the remastered and remixed, you know, Sgt. Pepper, White Album, Abbey Road, and stuff like that.
You're talking about the Beatles Through a Headphones book.
Right.
Right. Oh, awesome.
Yeah, so this is that's one of my favorite ways to listen to music is through headphones. Let's talk about this book for a minute. I mean, I don't recall ever seeing any book out there, you know, talking about listening to the Beatles and headphones. I don't know if there was anything out there before. I mean, was that, you know, an idea of yours that you just thought, hey, let's write about that?
Yeah. The genesis of it was a few years before I even had the idea to write about it. I was in my basement. There was a tornado warning. You know, Michigan, you will probably remember, Tom, tornadoes every once in a while. So the prescribed advice is go in your basement. So I put on the headphones and put on Sgt. Pepper on CD. And I started hearing things that I don't remember hearing over external speakers. So I had a little pad of paper, and I started jotting some notes and, you know, making notations about certain elapsed time, right? At this moment, you can hear this and stuff like that. Pretty soon I had this huge notebook of them, and I pitched it to my publisher, and they loved the idea. And they said, send us a chapter of one album. So I just chose Rubber Soul and did Rubber Soul, one of my favorite albums. And they loved the idea, and then the book did pretty well.
This is McFarlane, right? So this is McFarlane Publishers you're talking about?
Yes, yes.
So how did you get hooked up with McFarlane then?
They have a pretty robust popular culture list, and I liked some of those books. I've bought some of them before, long before I had this idea, and so I thought this would be a good fit for them, and they agreed. I'm happy to say.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. So, because lately the big norm now is self-publishing in the Beatle book world. I don't know if you know how far you go into, you know, Beatle books, but a lot of them now are self-publishing
right.
lately.
Go ahead, Tom. I'm sorry, I talked over.
Sorry, I didn't know if that was ever an option for you.
I didn't really think about it because I don't know it. I know that it's totally legitimate, and God knows I'll probably do it someday, but I'd rather have the force of a publishing house behind it. And there's some marketing stuff they do and some editing stuff, and, you know.
So, Ted, how long did the research take you for the first Beatle book on headphones? How many years or months of time did you dedicate towards that?
4 or 5 years. I listened to it over time, left it for a while due to life circumstances, kind of came back to it. You know how that goes.
Sure.
And, but that was great fun. I'll send you guys a copy after we're, through here. You guys should have that book in your,
well, thank you.
Yeah. So, I loved it. It was great fun. I had a lot of great interviews like this one after it came out, and, I met a lot of cool people who just reached out to me, found my email address, and wrote me. It was really nice.
It's cool. It's pretty funny. It's something you'd probably take for granted, that you think people listen to music on headphones, and I'm sure a good percentage of listeners do, but they actually never actually sit down and listen to it intently like you probably did. So it'd be interesting to hear to read that analysis.
Yeah, I think you'll like it. Obviously, the Beatles never intended to do stereo until about Sgt. Pepper, right?
Right.
Well, most of their stuff was recorded in mono and moved to stereo later. But the stuff from Sgt. Pepper on headphones is just out of this world. I mean, it's clear that they were very conscious of the placement of sound and sonic augmentation, shall we say.
Do you feel that the recent remixes that were done by Giles Martin enhance or detract?
I think they add. I think they augment to the canon of work. I have a good friend who just can't believe that they keep remixing them and keep saying, you know, they got it right the first time. Well, I mean, Abbey Road the first time sounds great, but it's yeah. so compressed in its first version. Giles kind of took the cap off of it a little bit, I think, and you can hear stuff that you just can't hear on the vinyl, the original vinyl.
Mm, gotcha. So this new version that you talked about for 2020, that's ready to go? You're done writing with that, or are you still working on it?
Oh, no. I'm just closing the McCartney book now, so I'm going to take a little break over the holidays and then get back at writing, get back to writing.
There you go.
Yeah. So it's a never-ending process, but I'm loving it.
Oh, cool.
We look forward to reading that for sure.
Yeah.
Right. It's a lot of fun. I was, you know, when I started this show back in 2016, the person that kind of, you know, influenced me to do this show, I'd call them up and ask them for some advice and just, you know, some knowledge into podcasting. And he said, if you get started, it's never going to end. And he was right.
I feel that way often.
You know, the knowledge, the reading, the listening, the watching, it's just continuous. It's funny how 50 years, you know, 60 years later, you know, we're still learning.
It's amazing. You know, it's amazing. You can still find new nuggets of stuff for stuff that we have dissected as a society backwards and forwards, you know, a thousand times over, and we're still finding things out. It's amazing.
Yeah, that was definitely the focus of that book, to bring something new to the conversation about the recordings themselves.
Gotcha. All right, well, speaking of new, let's get to this new book. So what is the Paul McCartney catalog, without giving too much away?
Yeah, it's basically a discography. I don't think that's ever been done, a complete discography, which includes all his studio albums, all his live albums, all his cover albums, all his electronica and trance music with Youth and the symphonic stuff. It also takes a look at all his DVD and video releases from the day. So it's pretty comprehensive. It's a pretty big book. And it was a massive undertaking. When I was writing about the Beatles, I had 10 years of music to dissect. This was 50 years.
Sure.
Right. I started with The Family Way.
Right.
There you go.
That's supposed to be my question. Next question, because it says
67. Yeah, I was going to be my question, too.
So, I mean, so were you familiar with that record when you started?
I was familiar with its existence. I'm not going to tell you I own a copy of it, because I don't. But it's easy enough to get your hands on it now, of course, right? And it's pretty interesting. It's kind of wallpaper, as John Lennon would say, right? And incidental. It puts the incidental into incidental music, and nothing that it's kind of lazy, I think. And when you, I don't know if you've listened to it much, but I think Paul just kind of said, "Okay, I got to do this. I'm gonna sit down and whip off this melody." And he does that like he's brushing his teeth, right?
Sure.
So. Go ahead.
And I think George Martin probably had a heavy hand in the production of that record, too.
Oh, it's George Martin's record.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think what Paul just probably wrote, you know, 2 seconds of, you know, here and there, and then said, this is what I'm looking for. And, and then George Martin took off with it. So
I think that was at a time, too, like, right, the Beatles were all stopping touring, and Paul is such a workaholic, he probably just couldn't sit still and said, well, I got to throw my hands into something, and did that.
They started writing for Mary Hopkin and stuff, you know, all that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So, but okay. So we've discovered that it's everything. It's the whole canyon. It's the classical stuff, the experimental stuff, the live stuff. What about the non-album singles? Because he had a whole lot of non-album singles throughout his career. Do you cover those as well?
Yeah, there's a whole section chapter on singles, and also re-releases, and sometimes he repaid like Flowers in the Dirt. I mean, he just kept putting new singles out with B-sides that weren't on the album. That's all in there. And that was probably the most exhausting part of this, because there is just so much.
Yeah.
Since I delivered the first manuscript for it, he came out with he dropped a new single on record day, right?
Yeah.
Right. Home Tonight and stuff. You guys heard that, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts on those two songs?
Home Tonight is awesome, and that would have been great on Ram. Really lo-fi sensibility. Really, really a great track. The other one, I'm, you know, sounds very much like Egypt Station, right? And like all the other songs on it. But I like that album a lot. I think it's a nice little comeback for him.
Okay, so what were your feelings on New? Were you not as a big fan of the album New then, or was it just because it was a 5-year wait? You know, maybe I think the anticipation for this album was a little, you know, a little bigger than maybe for New was.
I liked New. I liked the song New. It sounded much like Hello, Goodbye and Penny Lane to me. It had the same sort of jumpy chord sequence and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. And very, very hooky. And
gotcha.
One of the things that Paul does the best, obviously, right? Still. Egypt Station sounds newer, more modern to me. It is newer, obviously, but it sounds like he updated the sound and the recording somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I felt about the song In a Hurry, because it starts with that hops chord. You know, it sounds very retro at first, the verses, but then when it gets to that chorus, you know, Never Too Late to Celebrate, it sounds very new. And to me, it just sounds like he's combining the, you know, his retro and this new style together.
Yeah.
You know, he's coming up with a fabulous song. And for me, I think this In a Hurry, you know, for me, it should be the song that everybody,
which I agree with. And he brought brass back for both these songs, which was nice hearing the sax in both of these songs.
Yeah.
I love that. And he seems re-energized to me a little bit. And one thing that I say over and over in the book, not to spoil it for you, but his career got back on track when he decided to go back on the road. There's no doubt about that. The 80s were terrible for him. Really, really a bad time. And as soon as he went back.
Music, did you think?
What's that?
I mean, personally or musically? I mean, were you not a fan of the 80s output?
I liked Tug of War and Flowers in the Dirt, but I didn't like Press to Play and
Broad Street.
Wow. Not even Paul McCartney should be remaking Beatles songs, right?
Well, he kind of started a trend there. I mean, not a lot of people were, you know, redoing their songs in a way. I think Ringo had done Back Off Boogaloo, I think, for Stop and Smell the Roses.
Right.
Paul just, you know, I'm still up in the air about how I feel about him redoing these songs, because I'm just not a fan of people going back. You know, kind of like how the Eagles did and Hell Freezes Over, and they kind of changed, you know, Hotel California a little bit. Yeah. You know,
and
yeah, Rod Stewart has redone a few songs, and Elton John too on their box sets. Even Eric Clapton, I think, redid After Midnight for his box set. So, you know, I think he kind of started a trend there a little bit with you know, the older acts going back and redoing their stuff. But let's go back to the making of this book. What were you not seeing out there that made you want to do this book? You know, you had said that there wasn't really a complete biography of
and that's, you know, if I could just tack on to Tom's point.
Yeah.
And I think you'll know this too. There hasn't been a whole lot of pre-existing material available to research this stuff. I mean, you've got John Blaney's book, which I love, which is tremendous. Songs He Was Singing, which has been a great book to use to look at. But there hasn't been a whole lot. Only in the last 10 years or so has there been a couple of books that have popped out that actually attempt to cover all of his career. Luca Perassi's book, which came out, which is 6 years old now, 2013. I'm not sure if you're familiar. So there's not too many. So you've tapped into a world that there doesn't, for somebody who's as famous as Paul McCartney, the fact that he's got a career of 50 years, you would think that there would be mountains and mountains of books dedicated to his solo material, and there's just not.
That's true. And that's, I really had that in mind. And when you sell a book idea, as you guys know, you've got to prove to your publisher beforehand that there's not a lot of like product on the shelves, right, or available. And so that was a case I was able to successfully make here. I loved Blaney's book. I have only the first edition, so I think he's done some other editions.
Blaney's book that I have on me right now ends around Driving Rain.
Okay.
I've got the four volume set here. He's got
Is that an updated one?
Yeah, this is a four volume set. He's got one for the '70s, he's got one for the '80s, the '90s, and the 2000s.
Well, what does that go up to?
What's that? It goes up to 2000. I think the goes up to the last Electric Arguments.
Oh, okay. So that's a more updated set. Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Mine goes up to In a Hurry and Home Tonight.
Gotcha.
We actually delayed the production process to include that because we heard that he was dropping that on record day.
Oh, nice.
You know,
nice.
By the time it's in your laps, guys, he'll have a musical out, another children's book, and a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah. Content.
That's all included in there too, by the way.
Yeah, what do you make of all these exploitation of all these different releases of Egypt Station? You know, is that just him succumbing to the market and the demand? And just, I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable to see a market an album repackaged so many different ways, right?
It is, and I don't know a lot of people who are inclined, even big McCartney fans, to buy each incarnation of it.
I did not. I did not buy the Travelers. Tom did.
Yeah. And there's some good stuff on it. I like Frank Sinatra's Party a lot. but, you know, you could just download that stuff. I hate to be that guy, but rather than buying the whole package over again.
Right.
I bought everything, though, because I had to.
Right.
I went out and dropped quite a pretty penny on some of the bigger... the repackages and the remasters of McCartney 2 and McCartney 1 and the whole Paul archive collection, which is fabulous.
Yeah.
And which is pretty much going to put his bootleggers out of business.
Well, I mean, I think the one complaint about the McCartney archive series is the lack of bonus material on some of them. You know, there's not the Trevor Trove as say like the John Lennon Imagine set had, or
he's been a little skimpy. He's been a bit skimpy in that bonus audio department.
Yeah, the Wildlife packages is especially thin.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But I loved Red Rose Speedway. There's a lot of stuff.
And ton of stuff on there, and also a ton of stuff on Flowers in the Dirt too.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and McCartney, too, although the extra stuff is him just fooling around in the studio.
Right. It's
right.
But it's been interesting. I'll be interested to read your take on the archive series and what you've said about it since that launched in 2010, because here we are almost a decade into it now, and it's still not complete.
Right.
It's not. We're still waiting for London Town and Back to the A.
Yeah. That's why it's here. I'm begging for it. Please.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a couple of cool Denny Lane songs on in the can for London Town. And also, I want to get, I hope he releases a full live disc of the 79 British tour, their last tour, because they played some wild stuff on that tour. Valentine's Day.
Right.
Yeah.
Hottest Sun. Yep.
Unbelievable. No Words. They played No Words.
Oh, another great song.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's probably
got a lot
my
of...
favorite song now on Band on the Run. I'm so tired of Band on the Run. Don't get me started on that. But
that live version from that Glasgow show at the end of December is 79 is tremendous.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, well, his voice is... seductively fried. I mean, he sounds like he's been on a bit of a bender. Listen to Campuchia, man. Let It Be. Wow.
Yeah.
Shredded.
Yeah. Plus, he was still smoking in those days, too.
He was.
Interesting. Cool. Well, let's get back to the making of the book. I mean, when did you decide you wanted to do this project? Did you have the McFarlane's publishers, did you have their blessing to do this, or walk us through the story?
Yeah. I floated the idea to them a couple years ago, and they liked the idea and wanted to hear more, so I did sort of a little prospectus and sent it to them, and some sample portions of the book. I wrote out what I thought would be a good chapter list, and cited what would be some of my source material and stuff like that, the usual stuff you do when you make a proposal. And they said, yeah, it looks good. They, you know, they do a market survey beforehand to make sure you're not, you know, the market for this sort of thing isn't saturated. Once they determine that it's not, as they did, then they take on the project, and I'm glad they did.
Ted, in your research to do this from 67 until In a Hurry and Home Tonight, did you do this chronologically, or did you just cherry pick and go through stuff that you liked best to like least? What was your approach in writing and researching?
That's a great question, Andy. And I thought about doing it like cherry picking, like you said, but in the end, I started with the albums chapter and started with Family Way and then went to McCartney and Ram, and, you know, the order. And then it got, you know, so there's a, you know, a marathon race to the end of the 70s and then the 80s. I kind of took it by decade. And then I did the live albums, which I love. I mean, I love most of his live albums. I don't care for Paul is Live, which has sort of a weird sound on it. And yeah. I don't care for Good Evening New York City, which Paul is not in good voice on that.
On that one.
Yeah. But I love Back in the U.S. and Trip in the Life, fantastic. Both great albums.
Cool. Question. Yeah, I don't know if this is accurate information, but when I'm on the McFarlane website, it says it's only 143 pages. Is that correct? Because it does seem kind of a little light for a whole.
Yeah, you know, I know. I'm pretty sure it's more than that. I'll double check and let you guys know, but
that number doesn't say yeah, I was gonna say that number, unless they really reduced the font to like 8-point font.
Yeah. I'm glad you guys noticed that. I'll bring that up with them.
Yeah,
because it just seemed a little light about, you know, you're covering somebody's almost 50-year career, and it's like 143 pages seemed a little.
I can put it this way. The Beatles book was 275, give or take a few. And, okay. This book I produced more words for.
Oh, so there you go. So we know it'll be more pages then,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
Were you a big fan of some of the stuff, the electric arguments, the firemen stuff with Youth? I mean, did you have to kind of sit and kind of like force yourself to listen to those recordings or not? You know, as I have them, I'm not a huge fan of them, but you know, what was your approach list trying to get through those albums and some of the experimental stuff?
Yeah. It wasn't a happy experience for me, except for Electric Arguments.
Well, that's great.
Which I think is one of his most underrated albums. I really do.
Agreed.
It's fantastic. But that's the only one with, you know, lyrics and singing for the most part. The other is just like trance music to me. And it's, you know, it's a little of it goes a long way, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. So
it's not enjoying heavy rotation on my playlist.
No, not mine either. Not mine either.
Right. The one aspect of his career that I'm really starting to enjoy is his classical output. Well, I was lucky enough to have Alan Cozen, who reviewed the Liverpool Oratorio in Liverpool when it was first performed. And he was on our show to talk about that. And I've really started to have an appreciation for his classical work. Was that something also that was a pain for you to listen to? Or are you a classical fan in general?
I like classical music. I hadn't spent a lot of time, and I write about this in the book, listening to Paul's classical stuff, but I really liked doing a deep dive on it. So it's hugely melodic, like everything he's ever written, right? I mean, that he's got his stamp on it. Some of it's a lot to bite off and chew, like the Oratorio, although it's beautiful. Some of it's so beautiful. And when you realize what he's talking about in his childhood and stuff like that, it really is quite moving. So I enjoyed that. And in fact, I listened to everything twice over in order while I was writing about it. And it was really, really something I'll listen to again for sure. I was surprised at how much I liked it.
Did you ever try to contact any of the musicians or producers that worked with Paul for this book? Or was this something you just wanted to do on your own with your own perspective and opinions?
I thought about that a lot. Denny Lane came to my hometown to do a concert, and I thought about just going down there and telling him what I was doing and stuff. Denny's got some interesting ideas. I make the point when I'm writing about Wingspan that Paul made a terrible error by not including his former Wings members, all of them, in their recollections, because it's just Paul's. And while his recollections, you know, are valuable and a key part of it, those guys went through all of it too. I think that was a missed opportunity.
Yeah, he presents that Wingspan as more of a love story to Linda. It's more of a,
right, a family kind of thing and not a band thing.
Yeah, exactly.
But I will, yeah, to add to that, I will say that I think in the archive series, especially the one that came out last year with Wildlife and Red Rose Speedway, he's done justice with the previous band members to give them a little bit of a voice.
Absolutely.
And yeah. Say, you know,
because you don't mind.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So you don't mind, yeah. Because that Wingspan, although it was nice at the time to look at that footage, was it May 2001? I think it was broadcast originally. Yep. So it was nice to look at because we hadn't seen a lot of it before. But the whole thing really had a rushed feel to it. You had stuff from the 80s on there on the second disc. It just didn't jive with a true Wingspan archive set. And I think everybody kind of feels the same way.
And the book that came out to accompany it, that's where he really should have gotten some. It's an oral history of Wings, but it's just Paul and Linda, basically. And, you know, Denny Lane at least should have put his two cents in, right?
Right.
Yeah. The album and the CD release was kind of a missed opportunity, especially to release maybe some hidden stuff that, you know, never got released, like maybe Cage or Water Sprout or, you know, other stuff like that, you know, that, you know, never saw the light of day until these archives started coming out.
Well, Water Sprout was supposed to be on All the Best, and then it got yanked at the last minute.
Yeah.
Right.
Still didn't get a release, you know. So yeah, I mean, I would have loved for that Cold Cuts, you know, to come out that never did. But I'm definitely glad we're seeing stuff like 1882 finally come out, and all these other wonderful, you know, stuff that we got from you know, Red Rose Speedway. You know, the reconstructed double album was really cool to, you know, to have.
I think he's been, one of his things is he's just been afraid of criticism, and he's not really sure how people are going to assess his material. He's very self-conscious about his own material, so I think he's always worried about what people are going to think, so he doesn't really always make the best decisions about what to say or what to do and how to promote it. And I think finally he's got a good management team now that's handling the archive stuff, at least, and saying, look, there's a market for this stuff. It will be appreciated. People will eat it up. Trust us and put it out. And thankfully he's deferred to them on that.
I think he is getting good marketing advice now, and his total devotion to digital pathways makes that clear. I mean, he makes things available digitally only, drops it that way. The new thing that I discovered in writing this book was the Amoeba gig, which is fabulous live album, just fabulous. I was really impressed with that entire thing. And it came out in very many permutations, as you guys know. But the long one, the 22 or the 21 song one, is the best.
Nice that we have a full version of that show now. Really nice. Yeah. Instead of just the EP that's been out there for a decade
exactly.
or so. Yeah.
Exactly.
Can you kind of give us an example of you know, one of the albums you talk about in the book, just so, not without giving too much away, but say like for an album of Band on the Run, I mean, are you just giving your own personal thoughts and going track by track? You know, how did you cover an album?
That's exactly what I did. I mean, let's take Band on the Run. That's a good example. There's information like release date, who produced it, the musicians who played on it. Yeah. Its highest chart position, label, you know, catalog number, all that stuff, the nuts and bolts. And then there is a long discussion of the album itself, especially as it relates to you know, September 73 and Nigeria and all that stuff. There's a big discussion of all of that. And then I go track by track and examine each of the songs in some detail. The one thing I I said about Band on the Run, you guys will be interested in this, is that some of it hasn't aged well because he used the synthesizer as a main instrument, not as a coloring instrument. Band on the Run, Jet, Mamounia, 1985, it has this wild synthesizer that overwhelms the sound. And it makes it sound dated, I think.
Yeah. It does give it a distinct 70s feel, for sure.
It does.
It does. But it's interesting, though. So what it sounds like is you've got a hybrid of, like, biography, but also recording history, too, which is a nice, a different slant on it. So you've got, like, you talk about the recording sessions and in Nigeria and everything they went through.
Right.
It doesn't just read as a, bullet point, this is when it was produced, this is the songs. So it sounds
there's a long expository explanation for or view on every album.
Oh, that's really cool then. That's going to be really fun to read.
Well, it comes to the story of the album itself as well in there. The history of the album, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, the circumstances surrounding the recording of the album, certainly. And also, that album, as you guys know, was fraught with trouble. I mean, from, bronchial spasms to being robbed at knife point to the band quitting, monsoon season, unfinished studio. What else could there be, right?
Right. What was the warning when they got back and he saw a note saying,
All
right, don't go. There's been an outbreak of cholera.
Yeah, right.
After they already left.
That album's a major triumph. There's no doubt about it.
Well, for him, for sure. Definitely. And that's going to be, the album he's remembered for,
I think so.
Yeah.
When he passes, and that's, I think it's an unfortunate thing because it's, I prefer other albums out there, but it is popular album, you can't deny that. But are you a musician? Do you play instruments, or do you analyze the song instrumentation as well? Or
yes, I'm sitting next to my, and you can't see this because it's out of the shot, next to my Tascam 32 track digital recorder. In the background, you probably can't see because it's dark, are all my instruments and stuff. So yes, I do have a home studio and I record often. So, I'm not going to compare myself to Paul McCartney, that's for sure. But I understand certain things like chord changes and bass lines and stuff like that. You've got to understand bass lines if you're talking about Paul.
Absolutely. Hey, Ted, real quick, do you tackle any of the non-musical events that happened throughout his life, throughout the book, that give in context, like getting busted in Japan in 1980 or the passing of Linda in 98, to tie into what the music, or did you stay away from that stuff?
I stayed away mostly from that stuff, except to the extent that it relates to the music. Like, how can you talk about Run, Devil, Run without talking about Linda, right?
Right,
yeah.
Or Flaming Pie, for that matter. And how can you talk about the demise of Wings without talking about the bust in Japan? So it's definitely in there. I haven't glossed over it, but I don't spend a lot of time talking about it. That's personal kind of residual matters.
Right.
But it certainly affected the music.
Sure.
And the arc of the career.
Absolutely. Did you happen to tackle or touch upon Lennon's assassination at all in relation to the 1980s and what he did as a solo artist?
No, but I hope to live several more years, so that's always something that might be coming down the line.
No, I just asked because it's a curious point of research for me. I did some graduate work in Liverpool, England, years ago, and I've always felt that was a dividing line for Lennon and McCartney fans in terms of how they were both perceived. Lennon became sanctified and McCartney kind of didn't, and you wonder if that kind of had a trajectory on his 1980s output, aside from the commercial success of Tug of War, obviously, which was early in the 80s.
Oh, I think it did. I think that he was hurting for a long time in that Amoeba gig thing, which is 2007. He just literally breaks down when he's playing Here Today. And
Absolutely.
That's, 27 years later or 37. Yeah, 27. So I think that's always going to be with him and always sort of inform the work he does. He, as you know, Flaming Pie and Memory Almost Full. Those albums are filled with him looking back, even new, right?
Sure.
Early days,
right? Mm-hmm. And so he's not going to stop doing that. One thing I want to add, though, just so it's clear, guys, and you're asking awesome questions, but I want to make it clear to everyone who's seen this that this is all my opinion. It's heavily opinionated. So you might not agree with some of it, and that's totally fine. And it maybe gets a conversation going, right? But right. I've been wrong before, so but I'm putting my opinion out there, and there's stuff I don't like, and I'm pretty clear about it. So
that's cool. No, that's always fresh to see different takes, and
exactly.
And it'll bring out things that maybe somebody like me or Tom might overlook and get another perspective on it. So absolutely, they're always encouraged. Yeah. Another quick techie question. Were you able to use album artwork in your book, or is this just text?
Just text.
Okay.
I wish that we had, but there were reasons that we weren't able to. And
I'm not a publisher or an author, so I don't know if you could just pull these images off the web and put them into your book.
You got to pay for them. Yeah.
You got to pay for them. I figured.
Yeah. But I'm quite certain that anyone who buys this book owns many of those albums and knows what they look like.
Yes.
Yeah. And if they don't, they can just Google it, right? If they don't.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. What during this journey, what were some of the pleasant surprises that you learned that you were, happy to discover? I mean, there's some albums that you probably didn't, like at the first time you heard it, and then maybe you listened to it again and were pleasantly surprised, or an album grew on you, or was there anything like that, or did you learn something that you were, happy to learn while you're doing this?
Yes, one album that I think is so much better than people originally gave it credit for is Back to the Egg. I think that's a really interesting and pretty far out album. The guitars sound great on it. The vocals are mixed way up high, and some of the songs are really good.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I revisiting that was really a pleasant surprise for me, because I remember not being too enamored with it when it first came out.
Was that an album that you hadn't really listened to upon its first coming out, and then you didn't touch it for years and years and years, or you kind of knew it but didn't really, connect with it?
I think Arrow Through Me and Rockestra Theme were on my iPad for years and years and would come up every once in a while. But, yeah, I didn't spend much time in the last 20 years, 10 years, listening to the album from start to finish.
Yeah, it's different for sure.
It is.
Can you move a little to your left, Ted?
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's perfect. No, that's okay. Perfect. Yeah. You're kind of getting a little blocked off there, but no, that's perfect. Right. So, I mean, how long did you spend on this?
Yeah, I was going to be my ask for you, because you said the Beatle book took you about 4 or 5 years. How long did this take you?
The writing of the Beatles book took about 2 years. The research for it took 2 to 3 extra years. And the research for that book was listening, right? Listening and jotting down notes. And listening over and over again. This took the better part of 2.5 years just because of the volume of material. Uh-huh. And I examined his live stuff. There's a chapter on his collaboration with other musicians where it's not his solo work. It's Johnny Cash's or Dave Grohl's or something.
Oh, that'd be cool. So it's not just Paul McCartney solo song. It's somebody else he's testing on. Oh, that'll be
where he shows up. Yeah.
Yeah, Moon Over Jamaica on Johnny Cash's album, or Cut with Some Slack.
One he did with Ian Drury? I'm Partial to Your Abracadabra.
Exactly.
Stuff like that.
The one that I really love is the Songbird in a Cage from Charlotte Gainsbourg. I don't know if you've heard that one.
I do that one. Yes.
Yeah, and if you can get past the French singing, I think the whole album is really nice. I think that song is the only one she sings in English on that album. But it's a really good album.
They met for lunch and discussed doing something together, and Paul just mailed her a song or something.
Yeah.
How'd you like to get that in the mail?
Another question on the albums, only just because I just spun it before we started our recording today, is Kisses on the Bottom. How did you classify that? As a studio album, a covers? I guess covers, right? Covers, right? Yeah.
Along with the Russian album.
Right.
And Run Devil Run with three exceptions, obviously.
Sure, of his own.
And he's good at covers. He really is good at covers. The covers he does on the Unplugged are fabulous.
Yeah.
And I think he really connects with his audience when he's doing that. And I think that at times in his career where things aren't as great as they normally are, he sort of goes back to that kind of thing. Run Devil Run being a great example.
Yeah.
And there's another song, guys, I want to get your take on this if I can. That I just love that. I've only heard it a few times prior to the last couple of years, and that's the live version of All My Trials. Oh my God, what a performance that is. The gut-wrenching singing he's doing with Hamish Stewart. And the great arrangement, that is a seriously underrated song.
It's almost a forgotten song in the McCartney canon. If you're not one, if people like us,
weirdos like us.
Yeah, it's that All My Trial, the live version. Where was that live version?
Was it in Italy somewhere, like Venice or Florence?
Yeah.
It's in the book somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah, and again, without looking it up, I think that's just like a traditional song that he did a modern spin on, right? With lyrics, or did he?
It's an old spiritual.
Okay.
Yeah. It's been around forever. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he popped it up, right?
But he makes it like his own.
Exactly. Changes the chords and everything.
All My Trials. Now, but there's also a studio version of that also available too, right? Or no?
I don't know if it was ever released. I've heard that version, and I saw him perform the song on a British chat show, right? And once, but he's only performed it live 6 times.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's something that I don't, I've listened to several times. It's something I don't go back to often, but I do think the vocals on it are really, really strong.
They are.
Hamish's vocals are off the charts on that song, too.
Yeah.
He's not a bad vocalist. You know, when
He's
I did
a
see
great
him,
vocalist.
Yeah, you know, he was part of the Ringo's All-Star band this past year. And, you know, he surprised me a little bit, I got to say.
Yeah,
I mean, I did see. Yeah. The first time I saw McCartney was in '93, and obviously he was a part of that band. And you know, his vocals were strong back then too. I mean, he is a pretty good vocalist. So
it's great harmony singer on those live albums with Paul.
Yeah, that was
coming up.
Tripping
the Live Fantastic is just fabulous.
Yeah, he had a very nice band there for a while there with Flowers in the Dirt till the Off the Ground era. You know. Kind of forgotten now because he's had his current band with him for 20 years, but that was a good tight little band there, and they really did some great shows. They really did.
Hopefully, I think they were a good band. I don't think they're a little too adult contemporary sounding. They weren't as heavy rockers as the band he's got now. In my opinion, that's just my opinion, but they really killed. They really knocked those 60s and 70s songs out of the park.
But even like when they like listen to We Got Married live. I mean, to me, I love that. I mean, it might sound a little slick, you know, not as raw, but I think it's great regardless.
Two fabulous songs on that album. We could, you know, be here all night talking about how great it is. But are the songs off of his Russian album, 20 Flight Rock and Ain't That a Shame. Unbelievable performances, both. He just is so good at that. Interpreting Fats Domino and stuff.
Yeah, and I think that album got a nice another new lease on life because it got re-released last year on vinyl and CD, and maybe made some people appreciate that and say,
it's really good.
That's a wonderful package. It really is.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, I mean, he's got 20 Flight Rock down to a T. I mean, he can do that one in his sleep.
He had it down. He could do it in his sleep. He was able to do it in his sleep in 1957. I think he could do it in his sleep.
Right. Village Fat.
That's right.
Right.
If he had it in his sleep as a 16-year-old kid, I think as a crossing out on 80, he still got it.
Right.
Yeah.
What are some of your favorites throughout this 40-year career? What were some of those, you know, standouts to you while you're writing this book? And like, I'm so happy I'm writing about this album right now.
Well, for Wings, I love Ram and Venus and Mars. Those are my two favorite ones. The 80s, I I've said before, Tug of War and Flowers in the Dirt, really the best of that era.
No Stranglehold, huh? No Stranglehold for you?
I like Stranglehold, and I like the song Press. I do.
Yeah.
And Talk More Talk, right?
Sure.
And there's some interesting stuff on there, and I just don't like the fake drum sound and the, you know, it's too Phil Collins.
Thank you, Hugh Padgham.
Yeah, exactly. He's all right with Sting, but, you know. And I don't think Paul and Hugh got along that well, actually. But anyway, in the 90s, I liked Driving Rain a lot. I liked the live album, the live albums. And I'm trying to go through my file. Oh, Flaming Pie. The song Souvenir should be a number one hit. That's a soulful chunk of McCartney soul, I think.
Great song.
Great song, and some interesting songs on that album. I wasn't that big on New. I'm not sure why. It seemed like there was a lot of filler on it to me. A couple standout tracks on it, obviously.
Right. How about Driving? Where do you sit with Driving Rain? Where do you fall in line with Driving Rain? Because that's an album that either people love or hate.
I like it a lot. There's a lot of material on it. What's the song, guys? The rock song, the second song in, or the first song in that he did live?
Lonely Road.
Lonely Road is a seriously good rock and roll song. It really is. Not only to perform live, but to recreate in a studio. And he sings the heck out of that thing.
It's funny you picked that album because, like Andy said, it is one of those love it or hate it albums, and I think it tends more on the hated side.
Well, because you're comparing it and released to Chaos and Creation and Memory Almost Full and New and Egypt Station and all these kind of latter day masterpieces. You know that when you compare it to that, it might be unfair, but it you gotta remember November 2001. I want to say it came out. So
it was 2001.
Right. So again, a funky time. You know. For everybody, really, post 9/11, right? So it's kind of got lost in the shuffles there a little bit. But there is some individual great stuff on there, like that track Heather that he wrote.
Can't play it anymore.
No, right? Yeah, he can't. That's right. Yeah, he won't play it anymore. But it's a great melody.
Or Your Loving Flame. Same.
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah. That's over. That's over.
That's a
good song.
Yeah.
Love Rinse the Raindrops. I think that's a great closer of a rocker. I love that scream that he has like 9.5 minutes into it. You know, he just lets it all out. Great stuff.
Yeah, I covered the Twin Freaks album too. That's in there too. Oh, stuff like that.
Mashup stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, the mashup stuff. There's a little chapter on
mashups. Those are a fun listen too. Always.
I love it. It's especially nice in the car on a long drive.
Absolutely.
I'm glad you mentioned Chaos and Creation. That is definitely one of his best albums.
Oh, without a doubt.
And they just, you know, it's all him, pretty much.
Yeah.
And the song, and Anyway.
Think, yeah.
Is there a better pickup song than Anyway?
Oh,
come on.
That's a great song. And I think why that album did well is because he had somebody pushing him on that album. He didn't have a yes man. Nigel Godrich was telling him, look, this is crap. Come back. I'm not going to be a yes man for you, you know?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Vanity Fair said, I don't want to record that.
I'm so happy he worked that song out because for me, that song is his best song of the last 20 years.
Vanity Fair?
Writing to Vanity Fair. I'm so happy he fought for that song to get it on the record because, like I said, Nigel didn't want that song at all.
I know, he didn't.
No,
How dare you tell Paul McCartney to go back to the lab?
Yeah, I don't care if you're Paul McCartney or the guy down the street singing. You need a third party to tell you, you know what, we'll rework that. I mean, just to have how can you grow as an artist to have a yes man the whole time? It's not going to work.
That's why his only two really good albums in the 80s, Tug of War, George Martin, right? Flowers in the Dirt, Elvis Costello. He had people telling him, that sucks, don't do that. And those two albums turned out great.
Yeah, commercially, artistically, those were the high mark 80s for the 80s. Those were the high water marks for him.
Well, let's talk about changing things up, like on Press to Play. You know, not that it's one of my favorites. I mean, I enjoyed it, but it's not something I love. But you have to respect him for trying something different, at least. You know, I mean, everybody says, well, it's just like his Phil Collins album or whatever, anything like something like that. But I mean, at least he's doing something different. He's not giving you the same old every time.
You guys are going to love this book because there's a long passage on what you just said, Tom, about press to play and what he was attempting to do. And rather than regurgitate that here, I'm going to let you guys read that part of it. But you're right. So you and I are thinking along the same lines on that. You got to give him credit. He stepped up and really changed his sound in a lot of ways and took significant risks on that. There's a ton of people playing on that album. And there's
could one might argue that he's changing it up, or was he just trying to say, hey, this is the hip current sound, let me try to fall in line?
Yeah.
Either or.
Yeah. Because, you know, there's that, you know, because at first Eric Stewart assumed that he was going to be producing that album, and you would have to believe that it was going to sound completely different. You know, if he ended up being the producer on that album, you figured, you know, you've heard the song Yvonne's the One.
I love that song. Oh, beautiful song.
No, it's a beautiful song. And you imagine probably would have been closer to that in production sound than what we ended up getting. You know, it probably would, you know, get all that electronic stuff out of the way.
Yeah. You wonder if you had a true Eric Stewart McCartney collaboration, how much of it would the whole album have that whole 10cc vibe to it? You know, it's curious.
You should listen to Eric's version of Don't Break the Promises, which they wrote together. It's a thing of beauty. And Paul and Eric recorded a version of that, and I talk about that in the book. There's also a short chapter on Paul's podcast in 1995. Remember that, guys? The Westwood One thing.
Oh, yeah.
What's it called? I've forgotten now. I've just spent so much time.
But what Westwood One produced it. I actually remember listening to it.
Ubu Jubu?
Ubu Jubu, yeah. There we go. So I sort of dissect that, too. There's some cool stuff in there.
Ubu Jubu, that was before the internet. That was the only place you could get hearing some of this rare stuff, right?
It was the proto-podcast.
It really was.
Probably the first time you would have heard something like "I Love This House,"
right?
You know, which I
or is, "Flying to My Home,"
right?
Yeah. Or "Squid." I think the song "Squid" is played in there. I can't remember.
It is.
Squid.
Yeah. But it was the only place to hear that. I remember my local station, and I'm based in the New York area. They would play it, and like I would record it on a cassette, and be like, "I've got it. I actually have a demo. I have it."
Yeah. I did not. Do a lot on bootleg stuff. That's not what this book really is about. I treated it briefly. You know, you guys know there are 2 billion off the soundboard bootleg stuff from sound checks at concerts. I'm not very interested in that. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have the fire in me to do that.
Yeah.
Someone else has that book to do.
Yeah.
Right. I do prefer the, you know, officially released stuff. I do have some, you know, I have like 4 or 5 cold cut bootlegs, which I enjoy, you know. And I have the 86 disc Get Back Sessions bootleg, which I love to death, you know. But
we'll be hearing more of that soon because they're going over all those tapes now.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I can't wait for that Let It Be set to come out. And I think it's probably end up being May or something.
Yeah.
March.
Do we have any concrete date on that yet?
No, not yet. Still no
official. Don't you think it's odd that they didn't do that with Rubber Soul and Revolver?
Yeah.
Because they're like two of their best albums.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know why they missed the boat and they started doing it with Pepper. I don't know.
Pepper, yeah.
I think because Pepper was for so long considered the greatest album of all time. I mean, still some people still do consider it the greatest album of all time. So it doesn't surprise me that they started with that. I wouldn't be surprised that if they take a 3-year break after, you know, Let It Be and then start up with 60th anniversaries with, you know, like please.
Not a bad idea, Tom.
Or, like that.
Or you know what? Why even have to have it? Doesn't even have to fall on an anniversary. Once Let It Be's out, go. But there is no reason why we shouldn't have these treatments this treatment done for all 13 Beatle albums. I agree,
but it just seems like that's the trend right now. Let's celebrate the 50th thing. You know, let's celebrate the anniversary. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, and this all started, as you remember, back at the beginning of the decade, and I was living over in Liverpool at the time. So in, like, 2011, it was, like, you know, 50 years since the Beatles, you know, came into the cavern.
Right.
And it started year after year. And then, like, in 2013 was their first, you know, 50 years since Please Please Me. And so, but it really kind of ramped up in 17 with Sgt. Pepper.
Right. Didn't we get that 1963 bootleg from iTunes or something like that as well?
Yep. That came out on iTunes, like the all the stuff that would have came out of copyright at the end of 2013. Mm-hmm. Right.
And also the Hollywood Bowl remaster that accompanied Ron Howard's film about the touring days. Although I'm a little suspicious about that, it sounded like to me on headphones again, right?
Yeah,
and this will be in the new edition. That they jiggered the sound on the guitars, like they added some effects that weren't there originally, which I don't like.
I don't either. I'm not really a fan of that whole repackaged Hollywood Bowl. The film, I did not like the film, and I don't really like how they changed the artwork on the album. If they were going to redo it, they should have mimicked the 1977 release and repackaged it that way.
Right.
I do not like how they just rebranded the whole Hollywood Bowl thing at all.
It was interesting how during the movie, you know, each album came out and they said how long it was number one, and each album was less and less, you know, less and less time as number week. So by the time they ended up getting to, you know, the last album, whatever, it was only, you know, number one for a couple of weeks, you know. So almost was like how a band degressed rather than, you know, progressed.
Also, you have to take in account they quit touring, and the best way to sell a new album is to tour it, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, is there anything else you'd like to get out about the book? You know, how you can get it? I mean, it's available for pre-order right now. Is that correct?
Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, McFarland.com, any place that sells books, you can pre-order it now.
Coming out in January?
Yeah, I think January 21st or something.
Great.
But I'll get you guys an advance copy.
Well, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Tom, send me both of your addresses, and I'll make sure you get the Beatles book, too. Love to hear your thoughts on that.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe we can talk again when the second edition comes out.
That'd be great.
Certainly.
Well, earlier you said you followed two solo careers, right? It was Paul McCartney, and who was the others?
John. I mean, when they broke up, I bought all their solo stuff. Somewhere I have a vinyl Roto Gravure, which I'm not that proud of.
Don't hold it against you. Don't worry. It's not that bad.
No. The best song on it was written by Paul McCartney, Pure Gold.
Pure Gold. Right. Of course.
I did like John Lennon's career, although I have to say in retrospect that I like the first two albums, Plastic Ono Band and Imagine. Mm-hmm. And some of Double Fantasy, but everything in between is average. It is. I think he'd tell you that now, too. Find me a great melody on Mind Games or Walls and Bridges.
Out the blue. But that's just me. I'm a huge defender of Mind Games, so I'm a bad one to ask.
I like the album, too.
Out the Blue was my wife and I's first dance at our wedding, so
sorry I disparaged it. And I hope it's gone well.
It's 10 years, man.
Yeah. Out the Blue, I know is a one I think is a great
I know
one.
It's good. Yeah. Triple track vocals and stuff.
Yeah. I just think it's a little bit of a
A murky mix.
Oh, it's a horrible mix, but the 2002 remixes that were done really cleaned it up. And if you don't have them, they're worth getting.
I should get those.
Yeah. So would you say then that John's solo career and Paul's solo career, do you think John missed Paul more or do you think Paul missed John more?
That's a really interesting question. Paul's certainly had much longer to miss John, right?
And let's just say in those first 5 years.
Okay. I think that John's first two albums are two of the best solo Beatle albums ever, and maybe the two best. Paul's first two weren't received well, as you guys know. And so if you're looking at it from a popularity standpoint and critical approval, John was way ahead of Paul in the beginning. But starting with My Love and the Band on the Run album, I think Paul kind of takes over.
Yeah.
Yeah. You could definitely see the shift there.
Yeah.
Plus, with Sometime in New York City, I mean, that was a commercial and critical just nosedive. So,
yeah,
from Leonard, that. You know, so, yeah. You know, really, that was a hard, just, a, you know, first two albums, brilliant, and it just drops down. And then McCartney is, and we've talked about this in prior podcasts, 73 is active as ever, you know, releasing singles and doing
touring
Europe, producing the James Paul McCartney television special. So he's
Live and Let Die.
Right, Live and Let Die. So he's all over the place, and then he ends the year by releasing Band on the Run. So 73 is like where he kind of just takes off, and Lennon kind of just, you know, that's it. That's the line in the sand.
Do you guys get an advanced copy of my manuscript or something? You're stealing my material.
No. No, we're just two Beatle geeks.
Yeah, I know. Nothing else to talk about.
No.
Anything else about the book you'd like the people to know? I mean, now's the time.
Well, it's just a labor of love. It's a totally very opinionated, my take on Paul McCartney's solo career, and there's not much to it after that.
Yeah.
I hope you like it.
I'm looking forward to reading it. I can't wait, and thank you very much for sharing a copy with us, really.
Oh, yeah, no, you'll get that.
So is there, what else is next? I mean, besides that updated edition of Beatles, you know, with the headphone book, I mean, is there anything else you'd like to tackle in the Beatle kingdom?
There might be a few things, but I'll talk to you about that next time, all right? Because they're still kind of clanging around in my brain. I'm just now finishing the McCartney book, so
right.
I'm sort of laser focused on that and haven't really thought about the next, but there'll be something.
Well, we'll be tuned in.
Yeah.
Do you get to any of the Beatle Fests, like, you know, one in New Jersey and Chicago, the Fest for Beatle fans?
No, I have a good friend who goes every year to the one in Chicago, and he lives in the same town that I live in Brighton. Tom, what town did you
I was all up and down the East Coast of Michigan.
Okay.
It was not Rock Monroe all the way up until New Baltimore.
Yeah.
Mainly the Mount Clemens, Roseville area.
Yeah, yeah. Macomb County type stuff. Yeah.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
And he goes every year, and he says the Beatle Fest in Chicago is getting worse, and they're getting fewer special guests, and the program is waning a little bit, and I have nothing to compare it to, but I'm not that motivated to go to it. I'm not, for what I'm doing here, you guys are not going to believe this, but I'm not that into nostalgia, like that kind of nostalgia, like buttons and lunch pails and stuff like that, merch nostalgia.
Right. No,
I love the album covers, don't get me wrong.
So not the Paul McCartney.
Not all that stuff.
Yeah,
I'm not that interested in traveling to see it. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, especially if it's different. Like I live in New Jersey, so the one in New Jersey, New York is
right
20, it's a half hour away. So
right.
I don't go every year. I usually go every other year. I am going to be going this year again coming up. But again, it's one of those events where you see the same kind of people, but they try. But it's been going on since 74, 75?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Lapidus does a good job for what he's got. And listen,
yes.
I don't go every single year because I do feel there is a little bit of repetition to it and the merchandise aspect, as you pointed out. But if I do, there is a chance where there's a good panel of guests and authors that I haven't met yet or like to hear from. That's why I always like to go.
Yeah, I probably would have gone to Chicago in August had the book been ready by then.
Mm.
But it's hard to sell something that's not ready yet. I mean, it's not hard on this because you could pre-order.
I'm going to go to the one in March, so I'll push your book for you.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
This will be my first one I'm going to in Jersey, so I'm looking forward to it.
That's awesome.
You know, Andy and I, we may do a panel or something. We'll see. But
keep me posted on that, okay?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. What your plans are for that?
Yeah. We'll do. So, but this was a real treat, Ted. I'm really looking forward to you know, getting and reading the book. Like I said, you know, anytime coming out of McCartney, you know, we welcome anything that comes out of McCartney. And like Andy said earlier, you know, this last 10 years, there's really been, you know, a wealth of McCartney material coming out. So I say just keep it coming, you know.
Keep it coming.
Yeah, this is really has my stamp on it. It's not going to be like those other books. Those other books are great. But I'm hoping that a little bit of my voice is in it more than those. Those weren't that opinionated, I didn't think.
Mm-hmm. No, but they're highly
opinionated.
They are, but that's just fine. But there's so few texts available that actually tackle this research. So anything is welcomed, and I'm really looking forward to reading your book, and it'll be a welcome companion to what we already have.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. I really, really appreciate this. Will you let me know when the podcast gets posted?
Absolutely. Is there any way anybody and people can reach you, and you know, if they have any questions about the book or anything?
Email?
I'll give you my email address. Can I just send it to you?
You could send it. What I'll do is when we publish the podcast, we'll put your contact info in a link for the bio.
Perfect. And
the cover that's on Amazon and everything, that's the official cover, right?
That is the official cover, although interesting story. It was originally because before Egypt Station Traveler, whatever the heck that thing is called, was going to come out, you know, this fall or by Christmas. But when he announced that, we held so we could write about that and make it as complete as possible, which is an exercise in futility because he'll be coming out with stuff very soon.
You know it.
Yeah. But so the original, and this is like the Yesterday and Today Meat and Babies cover. The original cover of my book said 1967 to 2018.
Right.
We've changed it to 19.
To 19, so. Obviously now. Because
you got the first one. Just sell it on eBay. And
okay, it'll be a collector's item.
Yeah.
Well, this has been another great fun show, Ted. Again, we really appreciate you taking the time. Glad we could, you know, finally make the time to talk to you about this wonderful book coming out soon. And Andy, anything you want to add?
It's been a pleasure. Ted, thanks for sharing your thoughts and your recollections and your analysis. And I'm really looking forward to diving into the book when it comes, because I'm anything McCartney or Beatles related, I'll just gobble it up and I'll be happy to share some thoughts with you, but you know, you're just like us, so it'll be great to dissect. It really will.
Please feed back to me, man. You know, you write in a vacuum, and I'm in my basement, no one's around, and I've for 2 years writing all day or on the weekends and at night, and there's no feedback until it goes out. So anything you guys want to say about it, even if it's negative, I'm fine with that. Let me know what you think.
And as always, thank you to everybody out there listening to the show. Thanks for joining us. We're on Podbean. We're on iTunes. We are now officially on iHeartRadio. So, Andy, thank you for all your hard work on that front. So that's great. We are on YouTube. You can check out our YouTube, which is our video cast. You can type in Two Legs Podcast, and you can subscribe to that channel. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Two Legs Podcast. Also, our Facebook page, Two Legs, a Paul McCartney Podcast. So we are everywhere right now, and we continue to be anywhere that'll have us.
Absolutely.
So once again, everybody, thank you. So for Ted, for Andy, I'm Tom, saying everybody out there have a great day and a beautiful night. So long.
See you next time.
Listening to Two Legs, a Paul McCartney podcast, hosted by Tom Hunyadi and Andy Nichols, with musical contributions by Dylan Seaton.